Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Father Peter Stravinskas. Father Stravinskas, you were here a few months ago talking about the Irish situation. Welcome back. I'm just say you're the editor of the Catholic Response, publisher of Newman House Press, and you are the executive director of the Catholic Education Foundation. Before we get into today's issue, let me ask, what does the Catholic Education Foundation do?
The Catholic Education Foundation is a resource, we could say, for Catholic grammar schools and high schools around the country. One of the most important works that we perform is providing schools with an assessment instrument for their Catholic identity. So for example, 2 years ago we finished doing all of the Catholic high schools of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. This year we're working on the Archdiocese of Detroit and the Diocese of Fall River, Mass. And for the fifth summer coming now, we're going to be doing a workshop for priests on the role of the priest in today's Catholic school, which workshop you graced with your presence last summer at Seton Hall.
It was great. Look, I have to ask, are you getting a lot of requests to come in and do that assessment? Are a lot of schools worried about their Catholic identity?
I don't think the word is worried. It seems to me that the schools that were either not concerned about their Catholic identity or lost it, they're pretty much off the site now. Because in a market economy, parents are not going to waste their money on something that is just a mimicry of what goes down free at the local public school.
A public school that does a mass every once in a while.
Yeah, that's right. And no one's interested in that. And the teachers that are there today, these are, for the most part, very committed Catholic lay people. They're a great personal sacrifice, most of them making 30 to 40% less than they would in the state schools. And it's a generation that doesn't have the hang-ups of the people from the late 60s and 70s. Hmm. So it's a whole new ball game, and it's actually it's interesting work to be doing with them. In August, I spoke to nearly 2,000 Catholic school teachers of the Archdiocese of Detroit. And in October, I was invited back to do an afternoon full 3-hour workshop for pastors on schools. So the interest is certainly there.
Is the recognition growing that the way in which to succeed, we'll just put it in utilitarian terms, success comes not by imitating the mainstream, but by distinguishing yourself as different?
Well, why mainstream would you ever want to imitate a failed public school system? In the 60s and 70s, people admitted readily that the state schools in the inner cities were bad. We've discovered now that's across the board. It's suburbia as well. And then when you add the moral issues to it, so that from kindergarten, I was visiting a public kindergarten doing a student teacher evaluation, and right there one of the books for the little kids was Heather Has Two Mommies.
Of course, there we go.
We saw the story last week with a boy, a fourth grader in Utah, coming into school with ashes for Ash Wednesday, and the teacher made him remove them.
Right.
In your face, assaults on Catholic faith and doctrine. And so my theory, it's not a theory, it's proven, is we need the Catholic schools today more than we did 50 years ago.
Someone told me this morning that in his son's seventh grade classroom, they are getting, actually this is a private school, not a Catholic school, not a religious oriented school, but a private school, they're getting sex ed, seventh grade, and this week's lessons were on sexually transmitted diseases, but they had a special unit on STDs that are unique to lesbians. Mm. So it's not enough just to talk about medical health and sort of, we have to carve into these ever smaller identity niches here.
Sure.
And the son comes home and says, I didn't know that, I mean, he wasn't shocked. Mm. He was just kind of confused.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, this is
And they capitalize on the confusion and introduce further confusion. But you use the word niche, and it's my favorite word. When I give workshops to pastors or principals, I say, I'm a great believer in niche marketing. And what's the niche for Catholic schools? It's two things. Number one, strong Catholic identity. And secondly, a classical approach to education. And if you're doing those two things, you can be sure no one else in the market has it. And then you can explain to a parent why it's worth spending $5,000 for a Catholic grammar school or $10,000 for a Catholic high school. And because this is, we're doing something that nobody else either is interested in doing or even constitutionally permitted to do.
Is that recognition, again, growing?
Yes, I think so. I think very much. We see, particularly with the classical approach, there's a, you know, an entire institute now devoted to Catholic classical schools.
Right.
And that's a tremendously growing interest. In the 50s...
Is this an Institute for Catholic Liberal Education?
Exactly. Yeah.
I went to their meeting last summer at Catholic University.
That's right,
Washington. There were about 250, yeah. 300 people there. The energy in the room was extraordinary.
Yeah.
You could feel we're doing something and we're getting growth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
We're getting grassroots kids coming in. This isn't top down. This is demand. And you can feel it in the air.
2.5 weeks ago, I was invited to Louisville. There's a very interesting school there, Immaculata Academy. It's a K-12 classical Catholic school. But the most interesting aspect is they actually mainstream Down syndrome kids into the school.
Huh.
They have an annual founders dinner, which is their big fundraiser for the year, and I was the dinner speaker. But I was able to spend several hours on that Friday before in the school. And it's just amazing to see what kids are able to do if they're given proper direction and the enthusiasm of a faculty. I walked in on a third grade class that was able to do a polyphonic version of Ave Maris Stella. They start Latin in third grade. And they know the faith, but they also know everything else you need to know in a liberal arts education.
I would love to see more follow-up studies of how students from these schools are doing 2 years into college.
Sure.
Are they spending less time in the counselor's office?
Mm-hmm.
Are they spending less time in the clinic?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a big issue. Spending less time in academic probation,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, you know, when schools admit students, especially the private schools, a student who comes in and 2 years later just isn't doing well, either drops out or transfers or ends up flunking out, that's a huge burden for that school. One, you get the lost tuition.
Sure.
Two, you devoted a lot of resources, a lot of man hours to trying to save that student. So they want to admit kids who are not going to be problems.
Well, it's interesting. A number of Catholic colleges and universities in the past, I'd say almost 10 years, have a program whereby a kid who comes to them from a Catholic high school either gets 50% tuition reduction for their freshman year or completely free.
Really?
And the rationale is precisely this. We know what this kid is coming to us with. He has a moral compass, number one, and number two, he knows how to read and write. And it's worth the investment for them.
It's worth the investment. It's an investment.
Yeah, and some of these colleges actually then give the kid the opportunity to re-up for the scholarship for a sophomore, junior, and even senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And so parents are even saying, gee, you know, the money I spent on a K-12 Catholic education, that's worth it in a lot of ways, but now there's even a rebound effect at the college level.
Right. Well, you know, we're still at the point where a lot of kids go to college and never finish. Right? I mean, we can't seem to boost.
Well, they don't belong there, most of them. That's the first problem, you know?
Yeah.
And we got this crazy idea that everybody needs a college education.
Right.
Well, that's not true.
No.
And I remember one time in a parish that I was running, we had a plumber come in, and he had 5 kids. And all of them had doctorates. None of them were employed. They were all living with him. And he said, you know, I'm like Jethro Bodine. You know, I graduated from the fourth grade, but in 1980, he was making $40 an hour.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
And he said, I enjoy what I do. He said, my kids are all sitting home wondering when they're ever going to get a job.
Right.
So,
right.
And of course, if an education is geared to a job, you know, what's the point? Go to a trade school.
You know, one of Charles Murray's points when he talks about intelligence issues is that we may be reaching a saturation point in terms of the college enrollments. Yeah. We're pushing college, but we can't really break through about 35% of the population gets a four-year degree, mm-hmm. ends up with a four-year degree. And it could be that just for various reasons, simply the college curriculum, you know, the traditional liberal arts, arts and sciences college curriculum, simply only will work for about a third of the population. And the rest of the population, you can't keep telling them, college. They go and get student loans. Sure. They come out, they don't finish in 6 years, and they've got all the debt, and life looks very bleak. But the Catholic Education Foundation got a meeting this summer.
July 16 to 19 at Seton Hall University for priests, bishops, and seminarians.
2-3 days?
It's actually going to be 4 this year. The session that you participated in last year, the priests said it was 3 days, and they said, we think you ought to make it 4, because there's a lot, and as you saw, there's a lot packed into the schedule. So
they stay on campus,
that's right. And it's very reasonably priced for the 4 days with everything included. It's $600.
And
you fly into Newark Airport, which is a 10-minute cab ride to Seton Hall University.
To get to information on that meeting, the Catholic Education Foundation, what's the website?
Very clever. CatholicEducationFoundation.com.
Okay.
And if anyone wants to send an email to me directly, F like father with the last name, STRAVINSKAS@hotmail.com.
Hotmail.com. And all the information about the meeting is there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, another meeting that we've got coming up in June. What is it?
It's a Catholic writers retreat. And this also will be at Seton Hall. And it's a weekend, June 7 to 9. And it's a kind of a wide-ranging audience. Writers of fiction or nonfiction, poetry, journalists, but Catholics who want to understand their role as a living out of their baptismal commitment. And I think at times people have the strange idea that to be a Catholic writer means you have to be writing things about theology or devotion or piety. And Cardinal Newman, in one of his university lectures, talks about what makes a Catholic writer, and it's not that he's necessarily dealing with an overtly religious topic, but that he has a particular worldview when he's discussing anything that then makes him a Catholic writer at that point. And pre-Vatican II, we had all kinds of guilds for various professions, Catholic doctors, lawyers, police, and so forth, and a lot of places, those institutions have gone by the wayside. And so there's not a support system for people who are doing these kinds of works. And one of these areas is Catholic writers.
What would be an example of a Catholic writer writing as a Catholic but not about theological issues?
Discussing culture or history or education. There is a Catholic worldview. It's an incarnational worldview. We take signs and symbols seriously. We take human nature seriously. Pope Paul VI made the great comment that the church is an expert in humanity.
So if a social thinker, a social writer who talks about human nature as a myth, mm-hmm. is right automatically off the Catholic chart.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
And so when you do talk about human nature as, you know, going back to biblical sources for it and the church tradition, you can do that without talking about church tradition.
That's right. Well, you take someone like Flannery O'Connor, huh?
Right.
Very rarely did she deal with explicitly religious topics in her writing, but her work reeked Catholic. And because, again, we can't separate ourselves from deeply held convictions and orientations. And we get that from the Catholic culture. So the theology informs a culture, and we grow up in that. And and you know, converts, you would be able to address this issue yourself, may well know the Catholic faith upside down and backwards, perhaps far better than some cradle Catholics, but getting in touch with the ethos is really the work of a lifetime.
The First Things had an article, oh gosh, about 3 years ago by Dana Gioia, the Catholic writer. Today, it was actually one of the most widely circulated essays we've had ever.
Actually, you know, I'm printing that out as a pre-reading piece for the participants in the seminar.
Well, in that, Dana brought out very well just how powerful the Catholic writer identity was in 1955.
That's right.
And the list of writers who were explicitly Catholics was extraordinary back then. And it was recognized as such. What happened?
Well, I think part of the problem is that the Catholic Church in this country was so successful in educating generation upon generation. I look at myself, I'm the grandson of four immigrants, and I have two doctorates. You know, this upward mobility that occurred in the Catholic community, but it came at a price, and that was very often a tendency toward tremendous assimilation to the general culture. And I think we see that very, very blatantly in so many so-called Catholic politicians, they had great education, but they eschew it all in order to keep moving up the ladder.
That's interesting. So it was the broad socialization process taking place in which Catholic upward mobility just came into professional spheres, and the loss was people didn't keep their distinctive Catholic.
Yeah, the Catholic subculture essentially evaporated. Another part of the problem was with Catholic upward mobility, there was generally a movement outside the cities into suburbia. And the Catholic Church in this country historically did very, very well with urban ministry and rural ministry. But suburbia never really quite caught on. And part of that is we think of urban and rural as diametrically opposed, but not really, because there is a center. If you live in a rural environment, you have to come to a particular place to do your food shopping and other kinds of necessities, and the church is there, which is no different than from a neighborhood in a city. But suburbia, where you have, you know, sprawling malls and mini malls and strip malls, people don't even get to know each other. And so the other mistake that was made very often in establishing parishes in suburbia, they were done without Catholic schools. And so you have a whole meltdown that occurs, and no one quite caught on to what was happening until after it was an established fact.
You know, we moved into a suburb of Washington, D.C. in about 1969. My brother and I were 10 years old at the time. My parents had stopped being serious Catholics for different reasons, but every once in a while we would get dragged to church. There was a Catholic church there on Falls Road. It was in sort of placed, there was a subdivision of homes, suburban homes here, suburban homes there. There were some schools around, but it was just, it was one of those 60s buildings. It was sort of in a circle with stucco, low roof, inside a lot of wood. And, you know, they had the guitar masses, which my mother liked now and then. But there was nothing, if you drove by that building, there was nothing distinctive about it. It wasn't a place. It was just another building.
And that doesn't
create. And I don't think there was any school attached to it either.
And that doesn't create a Catholic imagination.
That's right.
There's nothing that's there, and you know the church has to be more than liturgy. And as I said to someone yesterday,
that could be the motto for your meeting. The church has to be more than just liturgy.
We have to do liturgy right.
Of course.
And if we don't do that right, we can't do anything else right. That's all true. But it's more than that. And I mentioned to someone yesterday, the parish where I grew up in Newark, we never performed a single significant human act off church property. School, church, there was a parish library, athletic activities, social activities, everything took place at the parish center. Yeah. And that's when, you know, we had a parish library that was open five nights a week. And the priest on duty for that particular day did his hour and a half in the parish library, guiding people to good reading. So my father was a common laborer, but introduced to Chesterton and Newman and so forth, reading these things with just a high school education. But again, everything was feeding in. There was a common vision. And even though some people couldn't articulate it, they were living it.
As Catholics went through the socialization process of becoming sort of part of mainstream American professional life, especially, did they feel a little bit embarrassed by their Catholic identity? Did they feel that it was almost an obligation to tone it down in these professional spheres, which are so secularized?
You know, it's interesting. This idea of Catholic assimilationism didn't really just occur in the 20th century. You had some Catholic bishops of the 19th century, like John Ireland in St. Paul, Minnesota, who was completely opposed to the Catholic school system because he said it's going to create a ghetto for our kids. He wanted them all mainstreamed in the 19th century already. And he was one of the ones embarrassed by an explicitly Catholic presence in society. So he was way ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And other bishops obviously opposed him, like Archbishop Hughes in New York, a completely opposite approach. So this is a temptation that exists across the board, but it kind of blossomed in a bad way in the late 50s and into the 60s. And then with the overall cultural meltdown, sometimes you hear people say, well, prior to Vatican II, Catholics didn't abort or contracept or divorce. No one did. It wasn't just Catholics. And so Catholics were not unique.
Divorce was, people don't know. Charles Murray's book, Coming Apart, mm-hmm. begins with a set of statistics from 1960. Yeah. And things like the divorce rates.
Yeah.
Well, they were rare, extremely rare.
And if Protestants had a divorced family member, it was not spoken about.
It was just
a nasty little secret. Keep it quiet. It's an embarrassment, and we move on.
Right.
But when the whole culture imploded, and very often Catholics were not given, either in the parish or in the school, a serious rationale for why they were living the way they should be living. Then it just all went by the wayside. And that's where the Catholic literature falls apart, the Catholic vision and everything else.
And your position is, to back to the schools issue, the Catholic schools are crucial.
Oh, yeah.
To the rebuilding.
Absolutely. And also, it's not simple. The Catholic school is not simply essential for the thriving of the school, of the church, but for society. We're going to be the only game in town very, very shortly.
That's why there's so much hostility against the church.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, our kids, at least we know they're going to be able to read and write and do basic math. I was at a supermarket a couple of years ago, it was a small purchase, and I wanted to give the gal two pennies to get rid of them, and she said, "Oh no, you're paying too much," and I said, "Well, no, you know, you're gonna," and I tried to explain to her that really I wanted a nickel back, but I was getting. And the man behind me said, "Father, don't bother. She obviously didn't go to Catholic school." and then when we made the exchange and I showed her how, she said, "Yeah, you were still giving me too much money." So just even basic math skills missing completely.
We need to revive a Catholic literary culture.
Yes.
Well.
And what we hope to do.
Self-identified and a literary culture generally.
Well, you know, I've always maintained, and as you know, I taught high school English and journalism as a young priest. And I always said there's a process. You have to read the right stuff. You have to be able to write about it coherently. And only then do you speak. The whole process is inverted today. Everybody's opening his mouth. He has nothing to say.
Everyone has a microphone.
Yeah. And so that's what we're going to try to also inculcate in our participants. And I think we'll be able to have, you know, experienced people like you and me and Bob Royal from the Catholic thing, helping novice writers. And also, you know, something that the left is very good at, they call networking. Conservatives generally are not too good at doing that. And we want to start a Catholic network of writers in these various areas of writing. Again, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, or journalism. But also give them the proper terminology. Sometimes you read some of these things that, you know, they're good thoughts that are there, but these people don't have the correct terminology, whether it's theological or ecclesiological, and it comes out like a silly Dan Brown thing. He doesn't know what he's talking about when he's talking about Catholic stuff.
Well, if Catholic schools are seeing a demand happen in part, I'm going to say this, I believe it's in part because they stand for something.
Yeah.
They have a firm moral foundation. They say, this is what we are about. To me, that should carry over to the literary culture. So the Catholic writers realize you can have confidence to stand firm on the moral foundations of Catholicism and of human nature and so on, because that's what people want. I mean, to me, there is so much hunger right now in American life for solidity, for firmness, you know, for an open statement of belief.
Well, you know, people talk about, you know, how distressed they are that we're a divided country. To me, that's a good sign. Western Europe is not divided. Yeah. They've all gone down the rabbit hole. And it amazes Europeans when they hear that Americans are still fighting the abortion issue, right? And making immense progress in that area, huh? And I think...
That's a very good example of where the moderate voices, those voices in the columnists, you know, the reasonable conservatives as they cast themselves, saying, what are we doing to one another? We've got to get over our divisiveness. Mm-hmm. And I said, how do you think you're going to get over the divisiveness of the abortion issue?
Yeah,
how do you think you're going to solve that?
Let's take the two extremes. That any abortion is reprehensible, it's taking of a human life, versus you can, you know, kill the child even after it's out of the womb. So how do we have a compromise? 4.5 months? That's unacceptable to anybody, you know?
Right.
And some things don't admit of the Hegelian, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
That's right.
And, you know, we've gotten away with doing that so often that we think it can be done across the board, and certain things don't admit of that.
Right. Does anyone want to say that the divisiveness over the abortion issue that we've experienced just in the last couple of months isn't the fault of one side?
Sure.
Entirely?
Well, see, the other thing you mentioned about, you know, the culture, the society, sort of implicitly longing for something more. I see that here in New York City all the time in a very interesting way. As a priest walking around New York City, it's impossible not to be greeted by people. Mm-hmm. And who are these people? They're cops, they're hookers, they're drug addicts, they're Wall Street executives. It's across the board. And just, good morning, Father. How you doing, Father? And just on the way here, you know, a 20-minute
nice
walk. And that's a sign that, you know, this is not a pagan culture, all right? And now, are these people, you know, going to Mass 10 times a week? No. But there's an openness that's there. And, of course, if the church has a very visible presence, which unfortunately is often not the case now, but where it is, people respond to it.
People respond, that's right. Well,
and, you know, as you know, I help out frequently at Holy Innocence Church on 37th and Broadway. The church was open for ashes from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. confessions from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and 10 masses, and over 7,000 people for the day.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's something that's still there.
It's there. It's not going to go away either. All right. The conference is June 7th
to
9th.
9.
And how do they get out information about the literary conference?
Probably the best would be, at the moment, sending me an email. We're in the process. We have a flyer that I can send to anyone who's interested. So F, again, and the last name, Stravinskas, S-T-R-A-V as in Victor, I-N-S-K-A-S, at hotmail.com.
Okay.
And pretty soon, it's going to be up on our general website, johnhenrycardinalnewman.org.
Very good. Father Stravinskas, thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks, Mark. Thank you.